Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture with me, Padraig Reedy. This week, critic Christine Smallwood with her debut novel, The Life of the Mind. Christine Smallwood is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and for several years wrote the Harper's New Books column. She's a frequent contributor to New York Times Magazine and to Book Forum, and she has also written for The New Yorker and Tea. Her fiction has been published in N Plus One, Vice and The Paris Review. Christine Smallwood, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
Great. As always, we'll start by asking you, what is your new novel, The Life of the Mind, all about?
Okay, so let's see if I can do this. The Life of the Mind. So the protagonist of the novel is an adjunct professor of English who lives in New York City. Her name is Dorothy. And when the novel opens, she has had a miscarriage. The miscarriage occurred 6 days ago, but she's still dealing with the sort of ongoing bleeding and discharge from the miscarriage. And as the book progresses, sort of time in the novel is linked to the events that are taking place inside her body. Dorothy has a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. She has a best friend. She has two therapists. And she has the second therapist who she goes to talk about her feelings of dissatisfaction with the first therapist. And as the book goes on, we just sort of like get a tour of her life and her mind. And I guess I don't want to like give away. I think there's like a spoiler in the book, but there is an event that happens with her best friend that brings a kind of coherence to the plot around the miscarriage.
It's been, I think, quite recently in an essay in The Nation, someone described it as part of a adjunct lit being a thing. I guess part of, like, it'd be good start to explain the kind of role of the adjunct professor in what that means. I don't know, we don't quite have the exact equivalence in the UK. We've close, but not quite.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So Dorothy has a PhD in English, and she does not have a tenure track job. So she's on a kind of renewing contract. And we don't get a lot of details about like where exactly she teaches. We're told that she has four classes, I think. And the deal with adjuncts is that they're just not very well paid. They don't have health insurance. And so it's a sort of way of extending one's time in the academy without having any of the job security that is supposed to be the big advantage of being in the academy.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot, I guess, in this, in the novel about, and we'll kind of come back in and out of everything, but there's a lot in the book about kind of, for want of a better phrase, status anxiety, I think, really, within the academy itself, but more broadly in life, in terms of, how are you, about what Dorothy's position in life should be at this point, or what her expectation is.
Where exactly she teaches. We're told that she has four classes, I think. And the deal with adjuncts is that they're just not very well paid. They don't have health insurance. And so it's a sort of way of extending one's time in the academy without having any of the job security that is supposed to be the big advantage of being in the academy.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot, I guess, in this, in the novel about, and we'll kind of come back in there and everything, but there's a lot in the book about kind of, for want of a better phrase, status anxiety, I think, really, within the academy itself, but more broadly in life, in terms of, you know how are you, you know, about what Dorothy's position in life should be at this point, or what her expectation is.
Yeah, so Dorothy's in her 30s, which I think is a time that most people, if they kind of have a traditional like Bildung arc of what their life will be like, that's a time when people should, in quotes, should be, you know, have acquired capital. Maybe you own an apartment, maybe you're married, maybe you have children, maybe you have a steady career, but Dorothy still feels that she's in this kind of limbo. And the sort of like affective landscape of the book is all about that contingency. I mean, the word precarity has gotten used a lot talking about the book. And yeah, she does have a kind of anxiety about not being, I think, where she had assumed she would be. And then her best friend who has inherited wealth is the kind of like contrast with her that she's always kind of comparing herself to.
Mm-hmm. I think that's... there's quite a bit about quite a lot that talking about, you know, specifically to different people who were taught to be on the similar track, very clearly kind of people who were, you know, in the post-grad kind of common rooms together, people who were, you know, even ex-boyfriends who were like very, you know, are all kind of seem to be on track and seem to be doing things very coherently. But there's a, I guess, tied into that is, and something that pops up again and again is Dorothy's sense of narrative, that there is and should be a progression to things.
Yeah, I mean, I think like Dorothy is trying to figure out what it means to live in a world where that traditional narrative is no longer operating. So, you know, one of the things I did in the book was I put the ending, right, the end of the pregnancy happens at the beginning of the book, right? And so, and then one of like the things I was thinking when I was writing was, okay, if we put the ending at the beginning, then what happens after the supposed end? Mm-hmm. And in Dorothy's case, there's a sense of like things feel like they're ending, but nothing ever actually ends. Mm-hmm. And so like the pregnancy is one situation of that, but then of course the job situation is another.
The miscarriage itself just continues, really. There's no for an unusually long time, but never seems to be, nothing resolves.
Yeah, exactly. It just kind of lingers. Yeah.
Mm. Going back to the pregnancy and the miscarriage, I think there's something again in Dorothy's parents. We never get a sense. I think they're tying in with the kind of where you're supposed to be in your 30s and having a baby. Mm-hmm. So you never quite get a sense of whether Dorothy really wanted the pregnancy or not. You know, it's neither a tragedy or a blessing that the pregnancy is avoided in the end.
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the things that I wanted to show with this character was to think about how sort of difficult it is for her to know what she wants. And so we're told in the book that the miscarriage occurred like before she had decided whether she was going to keep the pregnancy. And of course, like a pregnancy is, you know, outside of a miscarriage, it's something that one really does make a choice about. You know, at a certain point, you have to like, you know, either continue the pregnancy or you have to terminate the pregnancy. And then in this case, she sort of feels like the agency of making the choice has been taken away from her. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like an example of her general inability to feel like very much of an agent in her life across the board.
Yeah. Yeah. And her partner, Rog, is somewhat, I guess he's somewhat, no, I don't want to say not part of it because that sounds terribly kind of entitled, but there is always a sense that Rog is semi-distant.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. And I think Dorothy, you know, she makes it very clear that she feels like whatever she's going through, she feels like it's her thing, that it's not a shared experience. So there's a degree of distance built into the relationship. And I think people obviously have different impressions of the character of Raj. I think that we're invited to see that there was something like adaptive and good about the distance in the relationship. But then in this circumstance, it becomes a kind of deepening of her isolation.
Yeah, I think she's said something to the effect that that she appreciates the fact that he grants her this privacy, but it's never quite made clear whether how happy he is with that, or as you say, is that actually her convincing herself that isolation is what she wants.
Yeah, and he's the only male character in the book. I mean, there's a sort of walk-on of a man that Dorothy knew in graduate school, but in terms of like characters that Dorothy actually really has substantive interactions with, he's the only man.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned she has a friend, Gabby, who provides somewhat, provides some of the contrast. Tell us a bit about Gabby's role, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like, Gabby is Dorothy's best friend, like the relationship with Raj, there's a certain amount of distance and deception built into it. I mean, I guess one of the things about the book I haven't said yet is that the miscarriage is a secret. So Dorothy the only person who knows is Raj and then her doctor, obviously. But so all throughout the book, whenever she's interacting with Gabby, there's always this sense that she's withholding or keeping this information from one of the people who might be able to help her with her feelings around it. And so there's a way that she's always kind of like seeking care and then sort of refusing it. You know, she has two therapists, but with neither of them is she discussing the actually most important thing that's going on.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a sense where we see at a few times throughout the book, not just that Dorothy lied to kind of keep things secret, but she actually lies about things in order to keep them private rather than simply just not telling people. She actively deceives people about her life.
Yeah, I mean, she goes from withholding to actually lying. And kind of like at the point of the book where I think in another novel, you might have like a breakthrough moment or a moment when two people who haven't been communicating well finally communicate or like have a moment of real intimacy. In this book, it's actually a moment of like deepening isolation. And there is an intimacy and a connection that happens, but it's built on a lie.
Mm. I'm really glad you brought up the point of there being a breakthrough moment or anything like that, and the lack thereof, because it's something that really comes up again and again for what I was reading, is that Dorothy herself is constantly looking for some kind of epiphany or breakthrough moment. And the thing that I really enjoyed was the description of other people's PhDs. There was Alex, touches maybe about Alexandra and Doors.
So Dorothy had a member of her cohort when she was in graduate school named Alexandra, whose research was on Doors in the novel. And it's a joke. I mean, it's a joke about some areas of scholarly inquiry.
Yeah. But the Doors, there's nothing terribly hackneyed. There's nothing on the other side of the door. It's just, it's an entire thesis that's just, there are some doors.
Yeah. Doors, and who made them? I mean, I think Alexandra's like a kind of historicist, she probably knows everything about the factory where doors were manufactured at the time the book was written or whatever. But it's meant to like highlight how Dorothy is always angsting about her own work and her own ideas. And then there are these people who sort of traipse through the world just like doing whatever and seeming to have like no problems about it. I mean, we do find out at a certain point that Alexandra's path has not been quite as easy as it looks, but her research is a bit silly. Although Dorothy then does say that she feels like maybe there could be something really interesting to be done with doors.
But it hasn't been done by Alexandra.
No.
But I guess that's the thing. I get it. As I say, it's all she wants to, her research, again, she doesn't seem to be satisfied with the idea that you could just write something that's quite interesting and leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the book is like so much about shame and like the shame around the pregnancy, but also the shame around writing in general. And, the one thing that the book really does like really withhold is Dorothy's own intellectual project. We know that she's this PhD, like we know that she's an adjunct professor, like presumably this is what her life is built around. And yet we have only like the most cursory gloss on what her research is supposed to be about. And we don't really see her doing her own research. We see her kind of preparing for her classes. And so it feels to me like that's really the sort of like black hole of the book, is this person who's always thinking about ideas, but is unable to kind of like share the most important idea, which I think is like true for a lot of writers, you know, like sharing your work is so scary.
I first came across your writing through Harper's, and you've got a considerable reputation, I guess, as a critic. And it's something that I suppose reading that and knowing you're a critic, reading the novel and knowing your work as a critic, kind of got me thinking a little bit about, again, is that professionalization, whether it's in academia or in criticism in magazines and so on, does that suck the joy out of literature in that everything has to be analyzed and contextualized and given meaning or derived for its lack of meaning, that there is no, Dorothy is stuck in this position where she is very stuck in that mode where something, again, I think, there has to be narrative, there has to be meta-narrative, there has to be, everything has to lead to something else and have some meaning. And she finds it, it's frustrating when it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, it's interesting, the question, like, does writing about things make us take less joy in them? I mean, for me, it's kind of the opposite, just like personally, I think that I find that I get the most out of something when I write about it, and then the relationship is a bit tortured. I mean, what happens to me is like, if I've written about something, then I don't really want to think about it again. So that is for me, like the big problem, like I'll do a piece about a writer, but then I don't want to read anything else that they necessarily do, because it almost just feels like I don't know how to explain that, or like a piece, if I like a review a film, I then kind of don't really want to keep up with that person anymore, although I will. That's kind of like a weird thing. But Dorothy, I think, actually does like have moments of joy about reading and literature. Like there's a scene where she kind of makes a connection between a poem that she's teaching in class and something she sees on the subway. And I think we're kind of meant to see that her intellectual life is just so like intermingled with her lived experience that there isn't really any separating them.
Yes, I think there's always an angle, there's always analysis, there's always. And as you say, there is a very beautifully rendered scene where she essentially sees the Ancient Mariner on the subway.
Yeah, I mean, it's like what is real life? There's a scene also where she's looking at a sonogram and she's thinking about the Magic Mountain. And I just think that we're meant to understand that this is just like, this is how she sees.
Yeah. Which, as you say, I guess in some ways it does. I don't want to sound like I'm kind of some, dying for like the raw and unfiltered experience, but in some ways it gives her greater depth and greater feeling if she can relate, an everyday scene to a grand narrative, to something as epic as the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah.
And that becomes a more fundamentally deep and even real thing. The relationship with Dorothy's relationship with her psychologist, with her psychiatrist, is a fascinating one. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So she has these two therapists. The first is kind of what I think of as a like traditional Upper West Side of Manhattan therapist who has like an office with sort of like global decor and is a little bit like maternal and motherly in how she treats Dorothy. And then she has this sort of younger downtown therapist who she finds out early in the book is going to have a podcast, but is not inviting Dorothy to be on the podcast. Like she's gonna, I don't know if you ever watched like Couples Therapy on Showtime, or there's Esther Perel, obviously. So that she's more like that kind of therapist. And so Dorothy finds a way to just kind of like feel like rejected by that therapist.
Because her stories are
just like not like sympathetic or relatable or interesting enough to be brought to a wider audience.
Even though she, you know, very clearly never wanted to be on the podcast, but you can still be upset by not being invited.
Yeah, yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy. We're talking to Christine Smallwood, whose book, The Life of the Mind, has just been published in the UK by Europa Editions. Christine, we talked a lot about, in the first half about Dorothy in the book's need for narrative. But the other thing that looms largely over the book is the ultimate narrative, literally the ultimate narrative of the apocalypse.
Right.
she's teaching a class on the apocalypse, climate change, obviously, you know, weighs very heavily on her mind. And we also discovered that she's come from quite a religious background. You know, it's suggested that she comes from quite a religious background. How much do you think, you know, which I know you do yourself,
mm-hmm.
How much do you think that religious background forces her to think about things in the way she's in these apocalyptic terms?
I mean, I guess I see her as someone who had derived meaning from her religious upbringing and then had sort of lost that and then transferred that to the world of academia or intellectual work and is sort of experiencing a crisis around that as well. And so feels herself to be in a bit of free fall. I think that her relationship to the miscarriage is heavily inflected by the idea of having had a religious background. Like, I think she no longer would accept that a like person has died. She wouldn't say that, you know, a life began at the conception, but she isn't totally comfortable with the idea that nothing happened. And so she feels like a bit stranded and is a bit, I think, you know, it's a sort of minor emotion. I wouldn't really call it grief, but there's something else going on for her that makes her kind of hold on to the pregnancy loss in a different way. And then in terms of her teaching, her intellectual interests, yeah, I mean, I think that she also, like many thinking people today, is wondering like, well, how, what do we do with the fact that the climate isn't, I mean, like, now I'm just kind of stuttering, but what does it mean to live and write at this particular point in human history, I guess is what I would say.
And for Dorothy, particularly, this manifests itself in, you know, what is a very depressing but also very funny motif of the Rath children.
Yeah, she has this vision of the sort of children of the future asking her, like, why she didn't do more, you know? And then she tries to kind of defend herself, but she really can't.
Mm. And she sends. Yeah, the reading again this morning, she just sends. It does confront you very much at this point, which is she signed an online petition. And things like, yeah, we've all done that, and we will all be judged, if not by God, but then certainly by these future Rath children. But
yeah, I definitely think like judgment is a big thing that Dorothy is reckoning with, and the kind of feeling that something or someone will or should be judging her, you know, yeah. And the kind of since she experiences maybe the absence of that as a kind of loss as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's the relationship with the psychiatrist, with her PhD supervisor, with Judith, her PhD supervisor, who is someone who can grant legitimacy.
Right.
At the stroke of a pen, quite literally. Speaking of the answer with Judith, so Judith turns up early on, as you mentioned, as this background figure. And then we're kind of confronted with her at this this academic trip to symposium in Vegas, which seems for a European, a very strange place to have an academic conference.
They happen everywhere.
Yeah. But the strange and the discussion of this, like, kind of, you know, the feeling among people there that you have to be kind of, we're in Vegas, we have to do Vegas things, is really interesting.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, if you've been to an academic conference, you know that there is a certain amount of just sort of like leaving the conference to do other things that will go on. And so if the conference is in a place like Vegas, people are going to go and, you know, walk on the strip or gamble at the casinos or just sort of marvel at the Vegasness.
Mm-hmm. But there's even a point where Dorothy feels kind of, and I've never been to Vegas, so I'm sure it is what happens. She feels very obliged to spend some money on slot machines, which she doesn't seem to take any joy from whatsoever.
I mean, I think everyone should go to Vegas at least once. It's like a pretty interesting, place to go.
It's interesting. Yeah. Sorry.
No, go on.
It's something that Judith talks about in the conversation of Vegas, in Vegas with Dorothy about, you know, Vegas itself being an artistic or imaginative creation, the fact that they've decided we're going to make Venice. What we want Venice, we'll just make it.
Right. And it will be the only Venice, I think, is what they talk about, how when actual Venice is underwater, like this Venice will still be there.
Mm-hmm. Which I guess it's interesting view of kind of, you know, of the act of creation and narrative creation, about how you kind of, well, it exists. You can't see them. There will be a point, as you say, where it will be the only one. So whether it's the true one or not, you know,
right,
becomes then an interesting point for debate.
Right.
I was looking at some of the reviews that came in. My favorite was definitely John Self in the Times, who said, called it 200 pages of solid entertainment. It's a lot.
I know. I'm sure it hasn't like sounded super fun to people listening, but I'm glad that he enjoyed it.
But he didn't. But I enjoyed it. I found myself laughing out loud a lot. And you know, there are, it's been very clear to us, as you say, it deals with some fairly complex things, but it is very, very funny. Is that something that you kind of, I guess, you know, when you're creating that kind of character. I mean, is she consciously funny?
Is Dorothy trying to be funny? I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, for me, like as the author, I wanted Dorothy to be extremely vulnerable. And I do think that like in extreme vulnerability, we find a lot of humor, you know, but I mean, I think I do think the book is funny. I also think it's sad, you know, and I think it exists like right at that place where sadness and humor come together. And I'm not sure. I don't consider Dorothy to be someone who's like cracking jokes exactly, but I think her way of looking at the world is very like deadpan, and she has like a very dark sense of humor about things. Yeah. But I do like, for me, I found the book really like, I find it really kind of excruciating, you know, because it's like, so I feel she's so raw to me.
Yeah. There is, I think I said, what comes through for me, I mean, is there an enormous vulnerability. I think that's very clearly expressed, and a slight inability to move in either direction.
Yeah, she's very stuck and feels herself to be very stuck. And when the book ends, I think we sense that she has like a little bit more, there's a little bit more movement in her than there was before, but it's not a ton, you know, it's not like there's been like a huge, you know, overthrowing of the way things were. And now she's a totally different person.
Mm-hmm. But there may be, maybe a small perspective shift.
Yeah. I think that there's been a shift at the end. So,
Not to give too much away. Christine, can I ask you to read from the book?
Yeah, I thought that I would read from a scene towards the end when she's at a party with Gabby and they're going to do karaoke. Is that okay? So all you really need to know is that Dorothy is at a party at her friend Gabby's house. And how much should I read? Like two pages? Is that good?
2 pages, perfect.
Okay. Around midnight, Raj nudged Dorothy and cocked his head. Gabby was hauling out a karaoke machine. The sight of the machine filled Dorothy with dread. Shit, she said. For a long time, she had loved karaoke. Honestly, she had loved it too much. The love was frantic, but also complex, a complexity born of her desire to expose herself and be known, and her concomitant dread of exposing herself and being known. Of all the forms this conflict had ever taken in her life, karaoke was the purest. Do you want to leave while we still can? Raj asked. Yes, Dorothy said, but I think it's too late. Gabby was plugging wires into the TV with calm efficiency, a modern-day Hans Castorp running the gramophone in the sanitarium salon. They used to do it in private rooms. At first, it had all been so new and enchanting, the sticky darkness, the bizarre accompanying videos about which someone always had something to say, the caterwauling audible from inside the bathroom when the nights other people were passing and other private rooms leaked into your own, and all this inside the dark and deep alcohol cocoon. Inside this cocoon, her voice was so good, so strong. It was amplified and loud enough to fill her head. Her friends and their friends were so beautiful. She could see their souls shining. It was an unbearable burden to love them so much. The problem with karaoke in those years was that it was so hard for it to end. And sometimes, depending on what kind of liquor she was drinking, in the later slash earlier hours of the morning, Dorothy became morose or fell into a funk as dark and soft as dirt. She might rouse herself out of it if someone encouraged her to sing again, or she might keep falling if someone started to sing a melancholy song. There was a variety of funk that Dorothy liked settling into, aided by nostalgic songs, when she felt the fragility of her ebbing youth and the sweet ache of pleasure she had known or missed. There was another funk that was loneliness and grief, and sometimes these two funks blended together into an overpowering pang of life and death, in which Dorothy experienced the smallness of her being knit into the large, incomprehensible whole of everything else. Great passions were expressed and mourned. She would come home wound up like a clock, pulsing with all the songs sung and unsung, running on anxiety and regret, amped up and disappointed, wanting more and also wanting to have had much less.
So The Life of the Mind is published by Europa and is available now. Christine Smallwood, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was presented by me, Padraig Reedy, and edited by Sky Redman. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. And remember to check out littleatoms.com for a full archive. Thank you for listening.
it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.